Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline. Get in the mix at betonline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
All right, I'm sitting here with Ken Shamrock, at one time the world's most dangerous man, at this time still extremely dangerous. Hey, so let's talk a little bit about fighting. You're fighting at the House of Shamrock. You're a bad dude. All of a sudden, Bob realizes talent, and then you go to play football, and then you get your neck messed up, come back and play more football, but then you decide, hey, you're such a good athlete, you need a way to make some money. So you decide you're going to be a professional wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
So you go down to North Carolina to get trained.
Mooresville, North Carolina.
Mooresville, North Carolina. Now, was Buzz Sawyer one of the guys who was going to train you?
Well, Buzz Sawyer was Sacramento.
Okay, Buzz Sacramento.
Yeah. When I got with Buzz, my dad at the time was trying to find a pro wrestling organization or something because really I just got done with college. There was really nowhere else for me to go.
But were you a pro wrestling fan, or this was just the next step because you can make money at it?
I watched pro wrestling. My dad was a fan. I watched it.
Right.
Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer was there. Moondog Man was way before Buzz. Moondog, Pat Patterson, you know what I mean? So I know the history of wrestling, and I've watched it. I wasn't a fan like my dad was.
Right.
But I did watch it. I saw it. And I was always interesting and intriguing about it. You know, just the way that those guys would move and the falls they took. I mean, because I was an athlete.
Right.
I was like, man, that's still pretty dangerous. You know, where a lot of people were making fun of it. And I was like, I don't know, man, but that's still, I don't care who you are, man. You got to take them bumps.
Okay, Nate, down in Mooresville, you go to enroll in a school. The people that are going to be training you in the ring?
Well, when I first went down there, we knew who was on the thing. It was Nelson Royal and Gene Anderson.
Right.
Now, Nelson I didn't really know, but Gene Anderson I did know.
Gene Anderson from Ole and Anderson?
Yes.
Ole and Gene Anderson?
Yes.
So
yes.
He was, he'd probably been 50, 60 at that time, right?
Yeah, he was done.
Okay.
Yeah, and he would do a few independent stuff here and there, but nothing big. And I remember a guy named Grizzly, a big dude. Don't know. He was probably in his 60s, 65.
Grizzly Smith, wasn't it?
Yes, that was it, Grizzly Smith. Yeah, he was there. But Nelson, it was Nelson's school.
Yeah.
And so we get up there, and we're going through these tryouts, and I remember when I first started with Buzz, one of the discouragements that I had was that he didn't even have a ring. We would be out in the park doing stuff, and I was like, really weird. But
this is before you went to Mooresville.
Right, so I'm leading up because it's almost the same thing happened there, and then it changed on me. So when I was down in Sacramento, we drive up from Reno, and it was probably two times we went, two different weekends we went. It was the same thing, run, push-ups, you know, lock up, just simple stuff. And we were doing it in the park, and I was like, this is weird. Well, then we came up again, and Buzz pulled me aside. He says, okay, we're going to go down to this racquetball club in there, and they got these mats laid out. And he says, I'm going to bring a couple of these guys in, and they're going to try out. And he goes, I want you to go with them and make them quit. And I was like, well, like, what do you mean? And I hadn't been fighting or anything like that.
Basically, he wanted you to get rid of him so he didn't have to train him anymore, right?
They would pay an initiation fee.
You
and
get rid of them.
So when I saw these guys walk in, one of them was called the horse, the four horse something or another.
Yeah.
The guy was probably 6'6", 260 pounds, shredded. Well, when I look at those guys, I was like, okay, give me 30 seconds, right?
Right.
So I get in there and I roll with this guy and I blow him up. And probably about 2 or 3 minutes in, he's done. He just can't move. So Buzz goes.
Now, Buzz knew your background.
Yes.
From your high school.
Well, he actually
wrestling.
Rolled with me at the park.
Okay, so he knew.
Yeah, so we went live at the park. Right. So he was testing me.
Now, how was that? Because
Buzz is a stud.
Yeah.
Now, I got over on him, but it was everything I could handle. It was great. everything I could handle.
Yeah.
And so hey, I was.
What was your relationship with Buzz? Because, I mean, Buzz, I mean, to me, he was totally. Of course, I was a young kid when I was watching Buzz work. I wasn't in the business yet. He had me fooled. He really is a mad dog. I believed him, but I knew he was a salty guy with an amateur background. But I knew he was a little bit out there, too.
Dude, he was a madman.
So what was it about Buzz that was so out there? Nah, he liked a few you
know, he liked more than that.
Gimmicks and stuff. But.
I was there, too. I was in the middle of that when he did get killed. So it was wild because Buzz was a tough dude. He was legitimately a tough guy. That guy had a legitimate wrestling background. Even though he was heavy and big, he was fast, and he had a temperament that was like nasty.
Yep.
But on the inside, he was a soft-hearted, nice guy. I liked him.
Yeah.
I really did. I really liked the guy. But like I said, his outside the ring habits and stuff is what got the best of him.
Right.
He didn't have enough control. Got in with some bad dudes, and they slipped him something that was pure and killed him. He was killed. And I was there when all that happened. So then we had to go somewhere
straight
else.
Up, that's what happened to Buzz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm serious. That's the truth. In a bathroom.
Yeah.
In a bathroom stall. At a nightclub. And so after that, we had to find some other place to go. So we went down to finish up that thing with them. Yeah. I'd wrestle these guys. I'd beat them up. And then Buzz would take their money. Right. I did that for like, I don't know, about 3 months. And literally, we're getting nowhere. And we were still thinking at the time, we need to do something else. And so after we did that, Buzz would pay me like $50 or $100. These guys would pay like $12.50 to try out. And so he'd give me like, you know, $250 or something, whatever it was, something not very much.
Right.
And then that was it. So we were in the process of doing that before he ended up dying. So once we did that, we went and we found a Nelson Royal. We go down there, same thing. They had me running. Push-ups. Then at the end of it, though, he would have these guys come in, and after we do all this running, wore us out, and have these guys come in and shoot on us. Which I'm thinking.
Did he know your background?
No.
Okay.
No.
This is going to be fun.
So he had some shooters come in on me, and I'm not sure what the game plan was, whether because I had already been through it, like they were going to try and get me to quit or this and that.
You knew the game.
We paid $5,000, right?
Oh, my.
$5,000 for this back then.
Damn, that's a lot of money.
So I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, if they're going to try and rip me off, they're paying for it. First guy comes in, I just beat the crap out of him. Second guy comes in, I thump him. So then Nelson goes, hey. He brings this other dude in, right? He's a pretty bigger dude, heavy set. He brings him in, and this dude's a little better. He's got some good shooting ability.
Right.
Now, we've just gone on for about 2 hours, but I have, as you know, in my fight, I got great, great conditioning.
Yeah.
So this guy comes in, tries to take me down. I stuff him every which way. This guy gets tired.
Yeah.
And then I beat his ass, right? So then after that, Buzz goes, okay, you passed.
Yeah.
I end up staying.
Yeah, Nelson said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
6 months later, I'm carrying the strap.
Right.
Just unbelievable.
See, here's the thing. I started reading about you. And, of course, I've known you for years. We haven't talked to each other for years. But when you came to the WWF, I said, man, this guy sure did catch on to the game quick. I didn't know that you had gone to school to be a pro wrestler before you decided to get in to shoot fighting MMA UFC.
Right. You know what bothers me on that is that even though I got famous through MMA,
yeah,
a lot of these guys that I went and I do wrestling with, you know how some of the boys are sometimes, and they're like, well, he's not one of us. Yeah, that's how I started.
Yeah.
I was a wrestler before I was MMA.
So how many matches did you end up having?
My very first match was with Nelson Royal.
Yeah.
And I put him over, of course. You know, I mean, great match, too. I really enjoyed it. And then he saw the potential in me right away, and I started working with different guys. Ended up putting a strap on me after about 6 months because I picked it up really fast.
Now, where was this?
This was
North Carolina, but what's the federation or the strap?
North Atlantic Pro Wrestling.
Okay.
And so I held that for a while, and I was picking stuff up so fast. And this is before I did the submissions, you know, just the selling part of it and the work stuff on it. I just did and worked it out really well.
How was your working punch back in the day? Because you're used to throwing a shoot punch.
Yeah.
How did you develop your working punch?
Before I was a fighter?
Yeah.
I just did it. And nobody really complained about it. I was a little bit stiff in my movement on the ground and stuff because I was tight, you know,
right.
Muscle and strong. And so being able to learn to flow like that was sometimes they'd have to squeeze me a little bit,
yeah,
and, you know, give me the office. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I thought was really my strength was that I was never above and I was always willing to learn. And I never really put myself like I was better or that I was even more experiencing, but I always in a position to learn. I don't care where I'm at.
Right.
And it worked out well for me because through my times there, everybody that I worked with were always teaching me one way or another. I'd stay after practice and learn some more. I was always putting more time into it because I knew I was behind the eight ball. I wasn't where everybody else was, but right, I wanted to be there.
Now, and there's still a Nelson Rose was this. How did you end up in Japan? Because you ended up going, you went to UWF. That was your first stop, right?
No. Actually, I went to Baba's.
Was it Baba's?
Yes.
How did you end up there?
Well, I was at Nelson Royals.
Yeah.
And they were looking for some talent. And, of course, at the time, I started developing really fast.
Yeah.
And so Nelson actually sent me over there to learn some of the Japanese style.
Now, when you first got there, did you have a match or did you go right to the dojo and start learning?
No, I went right in for a match.
Okay, now tell me how that was. Because you're a guy, okay, so you're pretty ahead of the curve, but you're green. Now you're in Japan. And now, you don't even speak the language. So how was that first outing?
That was horrible. Absolutely a cluster. I mean, I was so lost, man. I basically just went with everything.
Yeah.
And I would do a belly to belly here and I would do a takedown here, but really in a cell, but I had no clue. I mean, it was so fast. It was completely different. The cell here and the cell there.
More of a register over there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so when I started the cell, they were like, don't do that. And I was like,
you look weak.
Yeah.
It's a register.
Right.
But how did the crowd mess with you any? Because now you're working for silence or, you know, on something as simple as maybe a reversal or get to the ropes. And, instead of working the crowd like you would, a stateside crowd.
Yeah, it was weird because, and a good thing, too, like I said, when I went in, I stayed after, too, because they had young boys work out after they were done with the matches. I stayed with them.
Right.
Because I knew after that first match, I was like, man, that was horrible. And I went to them. I said, dude, man, I'm green. I mean, I only have about a year in, 6 months into this.
Yeah.
6 to 8 months before I went over there, because I carried the strap 6 months. So a couple months after that, I went to Japan really quick for me.
And really quick for anybody.
Yeah. So I go over there, and I'm like, I know, man, this is a whole nother level. So I went in after, and I started just going for maybe an hour and a half after they were done. I would work the young boys. And it paid off because I stayed the whole tour. They sent some guys home early.
Oh, you stayed to say
I stayed the whole tour. And which was, you know how they work. If they don't work out, they send you home and bring somebody else in.
Yeah.
I stayed the whole time. And I think the only reason why, not because I was good,
because
I was willing to learn.
Yeah.
And I got a lot out of that, man, a tremendous learning ability there. I was so appreciative that they did keep me because I came back again and worked for them again. But the guys that I really enjoyed working with was the Pan Am Connection. And I forget their names, but one dude had huge legs, and the other one was a thinner guy, guys from Canada. And
It was Doug Furness and Phil LaFont.
Yes.
Yeah, Doug. I mean, Doug's one of my favorite powerlifters of all time.
Yeah.
Ungodly strong, super dude.
Yep.
He's no longer with us. But, great guys.
I work with them, and I tell you what, especially Doug, they were all good, but they really took me by the hand, and they led me through it. They taught me the ups and the downs and the difference between here and there. And it was a tremendous experience for me. It was one that I don't know if I would have been as successful in pro wrestling if I hadn't had that experience in Japan.
I got to ask you this, because Doug was a world-class powerlifter. Obviously, you see what he was doing in the gym. You had a 600-pound bench at 220. Did you ever squat or dead?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You squat and what you dead? Because, you're heading towards a pretty good total here if you can squat or dead.
I had a tremendous total. See, I think I could deadlift about almost 600, but somewhere short, between 550 and 600, depending on what day it was.
Right.
And my squats, and I was very strong, my squats was 515. So you're looking at...
You're looking at close to, an 1,800-pound total. I mean, because if you bring your squat up to six, if you work it,
right.
Because you weren't training as a powerlifter and you're already benching six... dude, that's 1,800.
Dude, the thing I had was that I had the ability to do that even at my bench press. If you look at it back then, I was 227 pounds. Yeah. I benched 605. The record then was 630 or something like that at that weight class.
Okay, you come back, and how long does pro wrestling last before all of a sudden this thing called the UFC is born?
Well, no, it wasn't UFC. It was actually the Japan deal.
Yes, Pancrase. I'm sorry. Right. I jumped.
Yes.
Pancrase.
So we was doing pro wrestling. I had the experience in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So people knew who I was. Then Dean Malenko, who was staying at my house, had came in because we brought him in. We didn't know who he was, but they wanted to know if they had somebody he could stay with and he could come up and work. And so we brought him in our house.
Yeah.
And he showed me this tape of these two guys that were on TV doing this thing called the UWF.
Right.
And I looked at it, and I was like, is that real? And he goes, well, it is, but in the ring, when they're in front of people, it's a work. But the style is real.
But yeah, it was like a stiff work.
Yes.
Right.
And so I said, man, I want to try that. And he goes, how do I do that? He goes, well, the guy that does this from the United States, the booker from the United States, is at my dad's gym. And I said, well, can I get up there and do, you know, I'd like to really try that. And he goes, well, let me see if I can see if they're going to send anybody or if they're going to even want to try you out.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, you know, I'd love to. So he calls him. The guy's name was Sammy Saranaka.
Yeah.
And he was out of Florida there. So they go, yeah, send him up. You know, they told him about my tough man contest that I'd won and my pro wrestling stuff. And he says, well, yeah, go ahead and send him on over. And so I go up there, I fly in, I go from the plane to the dojo. And they have me do squats immediately. So I do the squats. My legs are tired. So then they send in Bart Vail, which was at the time one of their top American guys going over there. And I just beat the crap out of him. I mean, he's a kickboxer. I take him straight to the ground. No problem. And just start thumping on him. I mean, I didn't anything to do but to fight, wrestle, and box, right?
Right.
So I thump him. They throw another guy in there, and I thump him. So really no competition, right? So they go, oh, well, good job. Sammy was like, good, pretty impressed, because I worked out for 2 hours and just kept going. The mentality was just keep going. So he brings me up to Japan, like I believe it was 2-3 months later, he brings me up to Japan. And so they do it. I didn't know this, but they're going to put me through a tryout. So I walk into the dojo. Right after I get off the plane, take me straight to the dojo. They have me do the squats. So, okay, so they bring out this kid, which I didn't know at the time, but he was a young boy. So he starts rolling with me, and I beat him up. Same way I did the guys in the States. So I roll with him somewhere about 30 minutes. So then they send another kid in. And he was a little bit better, but I thumped him. And so then I'm thinking, it's going into about an hour now, and I'm thinking, man, this stuff's easy. So then I see these two guys walk in with their bags, drop them on the floor, and they start warming up. And they're two guys I saw on TV, right? Masakatsu. Right. And Funaki, and Masakatsu Funaki and Minoru Suzuki. And I'm looking at him, and I'm like, it's two guys I saw on TV. And I'm thinking right in my mind, I'm going, oh, no. I just bit off more than I could chew. And so I was excited, though, really. And so it's probably about 20 minutes we rest, stretch out. And he goes, okay, you know, we're going to have you go with them. Don't worry about it. Just do your best. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, I'm going to do my best. I'm going to throw these guys all over the place. You know, ain't nothing I can't handle. And so they come in. Suzuki's a smaller one. He's about 180 pounds, about 5'8". And so we start going, and I stuff his shot, and I'm all
over. What are you weighing at this time?
I'm probably about 225 pounds, okay, 220, 225.
Okay, y'all are going.
So he comes in, and he's shooting. I stuff him. I'm pretty much, you know, first 30 seconds, a minute, I'm just throwing him around, handling him. Next thing I know, I'm in an arm bar. And I don't know anything about tapping.
Right.
No one told me to tap when it hurt. So my mentality is I just keep fighting. And it hurts, right? I know he's popping my arm, and I'm fighting. I don't know about tapping.
Right.
So they're going, tap. And I was like, what? And he says, if it hurts, tap. I go, what? Like, what to tap?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, yeah, okay, it's good. Yeah, it's good. It's like, no. So he stops. He goes, they explain it. You tap the mat or tap them, right, preferably them. And so the referee can see it. And so I understood it after that. And I was like, okay, my arm's sore a little bit. Thank God he didn't try and break my arm, because he could have.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. He knew I didn't know. And so he did it enough to where I could feel it. So I go back at it again. And then he gets my knee, does a knee bar on it. And so I'm fighting, and then I tap. And I'm usually a little far longer than most guys. I'm trying to fight out of it, right? And so they see that, and that's pretty impressive for them. So I go about 30 minutes, something like that. And I just get tapped out everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And I'm still controlling. Even though I'm controlling, he's still tapping me out.
Right.
So Funaki comes in. Now, Funaki's about probably 190 pounds, 200 pounds. He's probably 6 foot, 6'1", a little bigger. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm in for it. I mean, I'm tired. And I know these guys, but I'm gonna get mine. So we come in there. And
I love the mentality.
Yeah, so I'm going to get some. I'm go down swinging. So we get in there, and we start going at it. And I throw him down, and I'm just roughhousing him, putting my knee on his ankle, pulling his foot up. Just ripping his head, cross-facing him. I'm trying hard to just back him off, right? Yeah. And he chokes me out. I'm unconscious. It doesn't hurt, so I don't tap.
Right.
It's not hurting. He says, if it hurts, tap. So it didn't hurt.
Jesus, kid.
So okay. I went to sleep.
Yes,
I wake up. I've never been like, never had that happen.
Yeah.
And so I wake up, and I was like, what happened? How long was I out for?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, it's a couple seconds. You're good. They're slapping me. And
yeah.
I was like, dude, I feel so weak here. So we go at it some more, and he heel hooks me, and he knee bars me. He has his way with me, man. I feel like I'm in a prison cell, man. And this big dude just raping me.
Yeah.
And I can't do anything about it, man. That's how humiliated I was. And so after it was over, we got up, everybody shook their hands, and they were all like saying, hey, good job. And of course, I didn't know the extent of it, whether it was or wasn't. And so Sammy comes over and he goes, very good. And I was like, I just got beat up. He goes, no, but points to his heart. He goes, very good. I was like, all right. So I go back. I don't hear from anybody for 30 days. I'm thinking I was such a puss.
Yeah.
Like I was bad.
Yeah.
Right? And so they call up and say, okay, we have a fight for you in 6 weeks. It's like, what? So I go up to Florida and I start training. I start learning the heel hook. The first thing I learned was the heel hook because that hurt the worst.
Who teaches you the heel hook?
Sammy taught me first, the Saranaka. When I went up to Japan before my fight, I was there about 2 weeks before the fight, and I worked out with Fujiwara Gumi and Masakatsu Funaki. They're the ones that really showed me how to block the heel, how to set up for the heel.
Right.
And I learned that first because that hurt the worst. So I started learning a little bit, but mostly what I did was I learned how to defend myself from the submissions.
Right.
So when I went in and fought my first fight, it was in front of 17,000 people in Osaka, Japan. It's my first fight.
Yeah.
I'm fourth on the card. So I go up and I fight this guy and I beat him. Guy kicks me in the head, knocks me down. I mean, just it's a brutal fight because I don't know anything.
But dude, is this a shoot or stiff work?
No, this is stiff work.
Okay.
But
gotcha.
But it's a stiff work.
It's a stiff work. I got
I'm
you.
A new boy, right?
You know you've been there.
So they're gonna make sure that I'm in for the long haul.
Yes.
So they come after me. And so I end up beating this guy. I win. And so I come back another time the next month and I'm fighting in the main event against Funaki. Right? And so we go probably 12 minutes. And I've learned enough now because now it's about 2 months to where I'm starting to learn how to defend it a little bit. And so we're worn out. Even though it's a stiff work,
I get you.
I made him work.
Right.
And so he ends up getting me to the finish and it's done. Well, right after we get done with that, which is my life, the organization goes under.
Right.
And I was like, I found something I love. It's a hit. People love it.
Yeah.
It's over. Two fights. I'm like, gee, of course, I know how to deal with this anyways. I just keep going. Just go do something else. I'm pro wrestling time still. So about 6 months later, they come up with this thing called Fujiwara Gumi. And they broke off into Fujiwara Gumi. And this is where we start doing more of the shoots. And so I go in there and we start fighting there. But it's not a full shoot. It's a shoot.
Right.
Where you carry guys a certain distance and then you beat them.
Right.
But it's not a give me finish.
Right.
And so we go in there and I think we have two or three fights. The organization's starting to go a little bit. And it goes under. It's done. I'm undefeated. So I'm thinking to myself, I lose my first fight, which, you know, we know that's just what it was supposed to be. The second one was the same way. But these next couple, we end up, and I'm doing well. I mean, I'm taking these, and this is, and I'm doing it on my own. We go from this stiff shoot to a controlled finish to where it's done. Now, the next thing we do, which is pancreas, is a straight shoot.
Pancreas, straight shoot.
Straight shoot. The only difference with pancreas is that everything was real, but the difference was if we had somebody like a Boss Rutan or any of those other people, we would carry it a certain distance, like take him 12 minutes and then finish him. But as far as the finish, it was the guy that won was the guy that won, period. There was no give me, except for some I can't talk about, but it was nothing to do with the U.S.
Right.
It was just Japanese guys only. Right. But when it came to the international thing, straight shoot, period. But with the top guys, Suzuki and Funaki, more Suzuki. Funaki never. Me and Funaki always did a shoot. I can't say anything about Suzuki or any of those other things, but I can tell you this, that everything wasn't what it seemed, period. But that was the only one. Everything else was a straight go.
Right.
Other than carrying a guy a certain distance. And the finishes were real. So to me, when I started doing that was when I really found who I should be, who I wanted to be. And so with that is where I excelled, because I controlled it. I controlled it. I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to do.
Right.
And so after the first, I think, one or two times, the incidents and the things that I had to deal with Suzuki, and I can't say what, I had enough. And I said, that's it, no more. This is it. Either we're doing it, we're not doing it, period, done. And so from that point on, I ended up being me and created a good reputation for myself. I got to control everything that went on. It was great. The only thing I probably I look back on and go, man, it was stupid, was that it was, you know, because there wasn't anybody doing the stuff at the time, we had to make it exciting.
Right.
And so we took a beating for it, to carry guys a certain distance and then beat them, because they didn't know.
Right.
They're still trying to take your head off.
Right.
So that was a hard part. But probably, I don't know, a year and a half in, we didn't have to do that anymore. We had enough people trained up to where it was exciting enough and people can compete enough to where we didn't have to worry about that anymore.
Right.
So it was definitely a good start for me, because if it wasn't for me doing pancreas, that when I went into the UFC, I would have never been able the experience I needed to be able to compete in the UFC.
So then you're introduced into UFC.
Yeah. Yeah, that to me was, man. I remember I was doing the stuff over in Japan. And when I would come home, I'd have to stay over in Japan to get my training.
All right, folks, going to take a little break here to pay some bills. Here's a couple of words from my sponsors, and I'm coming right back.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
The wait is finally over. Football is in full swing. It's week four. Cam Newton and the new look Patriots head to Kansas City to battle Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs, while Big Ben and the Steelers face off against Derrick Henry and the Titans. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. You can get in on their season opening bonuses today and start off wagering on win, division, and championship futures today. Head to BetOnline today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. And don't forget to use code PODCAST1. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. All right, we're back at Ken Shamrock, the UFC Hall of Famer, sitting here at his home outside of Reno, Nevada.
Now, were they paying you okay back in the day? I'm not asking for numbers, but I mean, were you was getting by? Were you able to save anything, or just you make a living?
No, I'm making a living.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they paid me decent, no question. I mean, it was more money than I ever made in my life.
Right.
You know, and I got to do what I wanted to do and what I love to do and support my family.
Right.
Have a nice home. So it wasn't like I was going to retire or anything like that, but
right.
I was doing what I loved to do. And I made good money. I didn't have to do anything else. And so it was good. And then as I was doing that, I even got a fighter's house where I housed fighters. I put all my money back into fighting. A lot of people say, well, what'd you do with the money you made? He says, I put it back into my career. Because I had a fighter's house. I had a fighter's house. I had a group home for kids. I had a gym. I had all the training facilities that you needed inside that gym. I provided transportation for my fighters. I provided training techniques and trainers for my fighters. So everything I did, I put back into my career because it was going to help me develop as a person, as a fighter.
Right.
So when I started doing that, then the kid, one of my students actually brought me a flyer. And it had this thing, no holds barred, on it. Now, if someone came up to you before the UFC and says, hey, you want to do no holds barred? You'd go, yeah. You know, you think Hulk Hogan, right? No right. holds barred, right. You know, or you know, be a ladder in there with some chairs and stuff, you yeah. know, no holds barred. That's what we knew as no holds barred. At least that's what I knew as no right. holds barred. And so I was thinking, what do you mean? He was like, no, really, it's like bare knuckle, it's a fight. And I was like, let me see it. And so when I looked at it, it said it had different disciplines, different types, boxing, wrestling, yep. judo, jiu-jitsu. I was like, I'd never seen that, right, other than blood sport. I was like, so I called Art Davies, who was the promoter or the fight coordinator at the time, and I was like, yeah, you know, I was calling about this ad you guys had. And he goes, yeah, we're just looking for fighters, you know. What's your background? And I told him, well, I'm fighting over in Japan, and, you know, it's called Pancrase, and I'm the champion, and, you know, just looking to see what this is because it seems like it's something that I'm already doing. And he goes, well, you know, what is it called? He took down all the information. He goes, well, let me get back to you and, you know, we'll see whether or not, you know, because we're only going to take 8 fighters.
Right.
And I said, all right, well, you know, this is my information. Check it out. So he calls me back that day. He goes, you're exactly what we're looking for. And I was like, well, good. He says, so this is a real deal, though, right? It's not like you're going to come to me later on and go, well, this is how it's going to work. And he goes, no, it's real. It's the real deal. And I said, so you kick a guy in the head on the ground, you can stomp on him. You can. He goes, yeah. You know, you pull their hair. He goes, well, yeah. I was like, okay, I'm in. He goes, now you got to make sure you understand what you're getting into. And he says, you don't know my background. He says,
right.
I go, if it's one guy, no weapons, I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. I don't care how many times long I have to go. I says, it's better than what I've actually used to have to do, just fight 7 guys and get stabbed. I said, right. I think I'm okay. So he goes, well, okay, just want to make sure. And it's a good thing he did because when the fight actually started, I already fought. I defended my title because the whole time I'm thinking this is not going to happen.
Right.
I mean, there's just no way that they're going to allow this to happen. So I'm thinking it's not. I go to Japan 3 days before this fight's supposed to happen in Denver, Colorado. I go to Japan. I defend my title against that young boy, Fouquet.
Yeah.
He's actually a fighter now, right? So I'm fighting him. He's the number one contender at the time. I fight him. I knock him out with a knee through the ropes. Impressive knockout, man. Finished him shortly, too, which was good because I wanted a short fight just in case. Right. So I bring Funaki and our sports trainer and my dad to this fight. And so we fly from Japan, Tokyo, Japan, to Denver, Colorado, 3 days before the fight. We get there. First day we're there, there's nothing. I mean, you don't hear anything. Right. And you see a few guys walking around and have sweatsuits on, and they don't look good. They yeah. look like a bunch of street brawlers.
Yeah.
And so no press. So we're thinking this is a joke. I go from 17,000 people to this thing, you know, and I'm like, I'm not even sure it's worth it, right? But if it's bare knuckle, no rules, no time, it's the real deal. I want that because that's me. That's yeah. me in a nutshell. And I was like, I want that, you know. So we'll stick around and see what happens. So we stick around. They pay for everything. And the day before, press show up, about probably 10 press. And so we have this press conference, and then all the fighters are up there. I'm looking down the line, and I'm like, Gerard Godot is the only one I think I'm going to have an issue with, and that's not even going to be an issue.
Right.
It's just if he catches me, I'm in trouble.
Right.
But I get him to the ground, game over. So that's the only guy I really see. And another guy named Patrick Smith, who's got 250 fights right there in Denver, bare knuckle, but it's all below the neck.
Right.
And he's a world champion in that. And I was like, so and then there's this Gracie guy people talk about. And I saw some films of it, his armbar and stuff like that. But he's about 180 pounds.
Right.
And I'm like, no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I'm really not worried too much other than somebody might get lucky with a punch.
Right.
And so they switched the card up like 100 times to, I don't even know where I'm going to fight at because they're always switching it. Because Jorge and Gracie is the ones setting the fights up. So they realize that I'm the threat. The fact is, they wouldn't even have me on the card if it wasn't for Bob Meyerowitz, who was owner of SEG, who was the one that was doing the productions of this thing.
Right.
They wanted somebody in there that could fight on the ground too, and not just him. And so they didn't really want me in it in the first place. I was a threat right from the get-go. And that's why I kept getting bounced from place to place to place. I never knew where I was fighting. The whole time they knew what they were going to do with him and with me. And so when we get started, I think day before the fight, they asked me, you know, what do you think about Royce Gracie? Because this was really a commercial for them. And I was like, dude's in pajamas. He says, this guy's ready to go to sleep. I'm going to help him. You know, literally. I mean, I'm just thinking, just no, I'm cocky, dude, you know. Yeah. And so the fight the next day, we finally find out where we're fighting, right? And I look at it, and I don't think anything of it. But it's like I think he fights first, and then I fight second, and then me and him fight right after that, right? I think something like that. But I know he was before me, and then I was right after him, right? Or no, he was before me, and then one fight came on and fought. And then I was on the same side of the bracket. So this bracket fought first, which was him. Then the other first fighter on their bracket fought. And then this bracket fought right after that. And then, which should have been the other way around. But then I fought, right? And then right after I fought, I went right back in and fought him again. So he had two fights to rest from his fight, which he didn't need anyways. He fought a guy with one glove on, beat him really quick, Art Jimmerson. Art didn't even have a clue about what he was doing. I mean, right. He was a boxer. He didn't even know what he was getting into. If he did, he wouldn't have worn the glove and might have had a chance.
Yeah.
But so the way they set it up was when Hoist fought and he had two fights to rest. And then I fought. And as soon as I got done fighting, which was Patrick Smith, was one of the tougher guys in the tournament.
Yeah.
And ended up taking him down. He cut me on the eye with a heel or something like that. But I finished him pretty quickly. And they took my shoes away, so I never fought without wrestling shoes on. So you know the canvas was like ice.
Yes.
So I was trying to adapt with that on top of it. And so as I go back to the locker room, I have these uniforms I was wearing. I had a red, a yellow, and a black that I was going to wear for these fights. And I didn't even have a chance. I went from the fight into the locker room. Just as I got in the locker room, started to unlace my shoes. They said, okay, you're up. So I went from being in the ring, to the locker room, back into the ring again to fight Hoist. Not even a chance to plan or think about who I was fighting. And that's the way they had set it up, along with taking my shoes away, because they knew that I'd wore wrestling shoes. It was supposed to be no holds barred. If it was going to be that way, they should have took away his gi also. So then we would have been even.
Agreed.
So the fight happens. I get choked out with the gi. And it's not hurting me, right? I mean, it's like it's choking me. And the after this, I had an understanding of, okay, go ahead and tap, because it's training. You go ahead and tap. It's no big deal. You can just go on and keep training. It's a process of learning. So because I was rushed through all the stuff and doing this thing, it was really my mind and a chance to even adapt to it. So I go in the ring. I take him down. I'm on top. I get the heel hook. I go to sit back. I have it, and my feet are slipping. I can't get grip to finish the move. So then I end up rolling back up, and now the gi wraps around my neck, right? And he starts to choke me, right? And I feel the choke, and I go, okay, he's choking me. And so as he's choking me, I tap, right? And I'm thinking to myself, okay, we'll go again, right? Tap, okay, let's go again. And I went, after I tapped, I go, oh, shoot. And you watch, if you watch it, I'm on my knees going, I'm sitting on my knees, and Hoist, and if you know Hoist, and everybody knows Hoist, people will go, oh, he got lucky. Well, let's go again. We go again. They always want to go again, right? Well, as soon as he caught me with that choke, because I tell you, he knew, and he even came up and said, dude, you almost had me. And I said, yeah. I said, but next time I'll get you. Right?
Yeah.
And so as I'm doing this, and I'm slipping, and he wraps it, and he chokes me, and I'm thinking to myself, I got no grip, right? But he's choking me. But he's choking me with his gi. And I was like, because I could pull an arm off.
Right.
But I can't grab anything. And I'm thinking, isn't that a weapon? I was like, they took my shoes away. This is all within a 5 second, 3-5 second thought process.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking of this, and then Hoist jumps up, and the referee goes, fight, because he didn't see me tap.
Right.
So Hoist lets go. He stands up, and I did tap. There's no question. And so the referee goes, fight. He's a Brazilian guy. I don't understand what he's saying. And Hoist is arguing with him. And he's saying, looks at me, and Hoist goes in English, you tapped. And was like, yes, I tapped. He says, he tapped. And it's like, I'm thinking to myself, now that I look back, then I didn't know how they were.
Right.
But if you know how they are, most of the time, okay, we go again. Because they're always so confident, they'll beat you again.
Right.
With me, it was like, no.
Yeah.
You tapped. And I was like, yes, I tapped, man. Shut up. So that was my, and I believe that that's really, really what really drove the UFC was the rivalry that we developed from that fight.
Right.
When we went into the next one, because he kept trying to duck me after that. Never really want to fight me. And if it wasn't for the fact of that one fight that I went into where I had won both my fights, I fought this one dude, just beat him up, took him out. Go into my second fight, I fight a guy named Felix Mitchell, who was an alternate. Didn't even have a fight. He came in as a reserve. I fought my first one, beat the guy, which was a judo gold medalist, whatever. I beat him, he taps. I go in and fight Felix Mitchell, who was a fresh guy. I end up choking him out. I'm in the finals, but I have a damaged knee, and I had to shoot it up before I fought. But I was so intense on getting Hoist that nothing would stop me. I shot that thing up. I didn't even feel it. And so I get through those two fights, and I'm in the finals now, and I'm like, I'm drooling to get to Hoist. Hoist goes in, wins his first one, goes in the second one, and fights Chemo. And Chemo gives him everything he can handle. Chemo doesn't know anything. He's just a big, strong brute guy.
Yeah.
And Hoist holds on to his ponytail for dear life.
Yeah.
And basically rips his ponytail out. And so he gets handled. This is what really pissed me off, and people did not call a spade a spade. And this is what really, I would go in with a torn up knee because I wanted to fight him. I would go in with damages. I did it with Tito, with a knee, a shoulder, a neck. I would fight. I would, a tough guy, anybody that has any desire has to be told by a trainer to stop. And to me, that's the difference between somebody that's a true warrior and somebody that pretends to be. Hoist Gracie goes in and throws in a towel because he was dehydrated. And I was next up. Because he got tested. Because he may have to go into a fight and be a little bit tired and exhausted and fight through some adversity.
Right.
Like I had to do. He throws in the towel. Now, for so long, the history has been told and has not been told right. If you really want to know the insides, what does that make you? You may be able to go out and beat somebody because your skills are up there
right.
And you handle people. I give him all the credit in the world because he won four of them, and that's not hard. That's hard to do. And I give him all the credit for doing that, but I'm talking about his toughness.
Right.
I'm talking about his toughness and his heart.
Right.
I'm not talking about his skill level and the ability to know more than somebody else and beat him. I'm talking about being challenged, being in a tough situation and fighting through it.
Right.
He threw in the towel when he got challenged. That right there pissed me off. And I made sure everybody knew it. He's like, I didn't even go in for the fight. There was money sitting out there for me to take against a guy, Steve Jenham, which I would have just, come on, really? No, I knew
man,
it. Everybody else knew it.
So what did you just say? Hey, I ain't doing it?
I ain't doing it. I said, I'm not doing it. I want Hoist Gracie. That's who I came for. That's all I care about. The money means nothing to me.
But now when you look back, what are you thinking?
I think the same thing. I think if I hadn't have done that, Hoist Gracie would have disappeared. He would have disappeared and not had to fight me. Because I said that. And told everybody, I am not here for the money. I'm not here to go out and beat a guy who works at the fire department.
Yeah.
I'm here for Hoist Gracie, and I ain't leaving till I get him.
Right.
And so because I made such a stink about that, it became a rivalry, the first rivalry in UFC history, and everybody wanted to see it. Now there was too much pressure for him to walk away. I basically put a bullseye on him with the fans, and the fans were like, dude, that's pretty intense. A guy walked away for money, wants Hoist Gracie, and everybody's talking about it. He can't leave. If I go and fight that fight, I maybe don't say what I wanted to say, but it wouldn't have been the same type of pressure on him. He could have just said, well, they're not fighting the way we wanted to. It's not what I created. It's not my envision. They're changing everything. We're not fighting here anymore. It's like, I'll fight you anywhere, anyplace, anytime, like you guys say, with whatever rules that you want. Doesn't matter to me, but I want you, and I'm not fighting anybody else till I get you. That's exactly what I said. Now, there was way too much pressure for him to walk away.
Right.
He had to fight me, and then when he did, they put a time limit on it, which is against everything that they believe. They put the time limit on it because they knew that I had the ability to go the distance.
In that last fight, because you had put a pretty big goose egg on his underneath his eye, and the way you left, you were seemingly the victor?
Well, I mean, I...
Or in your eyes, you were the victor?
No. No, I mean, it did... It, what it
to
did
the people?
Do, no. What it did do for me... Right. Was that it did it made it really clear to them because they put the time limit in there, which really, really made it clear to me and I think to anybody else, they didn't want no part of me. They wanted enough time in there for them to be able to at least get an opportunity to try and submit me, but also, too, to be able to at least get out of there with a tie.
But then, with this being done, when did UFC implement the judges?
That came way after, I think after...
How far down the road was that? Because, I mean, it was a cluster back in the day.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Putting it mildly. I mean, well, but, it was in the stages of development, and everything does that. But
well,
I mean,
when you get a guy on the side like Hoy and Gracie, when I was fighting Hoyce, we had a 30-minute time limit. They put that time limit in there, right?
Gotcha.
So Hoyce ends with 30 minutes, and I'm pretty much wearing his ass out, which is what I wanted to do, just wear him down and then beat him up. And then submit them everything they said they could do better than anybody else.
Right.
And Horian yells 3 more minutes from the corner. And so they give him 3 more minutes, which is, I'm okay with that because I'm fresh. But Hoyce didn't want it. But Horian told 3 more minutes, right? They didn't say anything. They went, right? So I take him down. I beat up his body some more. I beat on him some more. And I basically got him where I want him. They stand up again. It's 33 minutes now. And Horian goes, 3 more minutes. And Hoyce looks at him. And his corner's going, what? Because now I'm really getting over on him. I mean, he's wearing out fast.
Right.
So he comes out, and then I blast him with a right hand. Bust his eye open. And then I start working him. And I was so close to doing what I set out to do, which was wear him out. Just really wear him out and make him look like just a rag doll. I mean, that's what I trained for. And I couldn't train. I couldn't change my 3 days before. I could not change what I trained for.
Right.
And so it was there. You saw how I was working it. Everybody saw the damage and the structure of the way I was doing the damage was methodically and slowly breaking him down. And so after those 3 minutes, went 36 minutes, we stand up again and we hear nothing from the corner. And I look over and I was like, because they had to pick him up.
Right.
They had to carry him out. And so I'm going 3 more minutes, but it wasn't, it was satisfying to me because I think that it did kind of set the stage that they were trying to run from me and that, that my abilities, even at 2.5 years, 3 years of the experience that I had, as opposed to Hoyce's 27 years and 50 years, family experience.
Right.
That the athleticism and the ability for me to pick things up very fast was very, very real.
So then the feud with Tito?
Yeah, that came even after the Severn deal. Boy, there was a lot of things that happened in between that. I became the champion. I choked out Severn, the first champion.
Yeah, talk about the championship thing, because I was going back over that this morning. And that was a super fight, right?
Yes. Yeah, the very first super fight was Hoyce Gracie. If your judge is there, you know, I win.
Right.
You know, it goes down in the history as a draw. But if it's in today's world, you know, easily, no problem. Fact is, they probably would have stopped the fight. A TKO. And then Severn, the very first one, where I'd actually, they gave a strap, was Severn. I choked him out. And you know, Severn just got done winning the ultimate, which was all the winners throughout the year in a tournament.
Right.
Severn won that. And so then I fought the winner of that. Because at the time I was the number one ranked fighter in the world. And so then I fought the winner from the ultimate, and that was Severn. I choked him out and ended up carrying that strap. I won that strap. And then Oleg Taktarov, same thing I did to Oleg that I did to Hoyce. I just put a beating on him. But if you look at what I've done, South Atlantic Pro Wrestling, which was after North Atlantic Pro Wrestling. I carried the strap in both those. Tough Mans, you know, I won all the Tough Mans, 3 of them. I go into fighting. I'm the very first champion in the Pancras organization. I'm the very first champion in the UFC organization, super fights, single fights. So the ability, and even in WWE and WWF, you know, King of the Ring, you know, which kind of lost at that one. Because usually if you win King of the Ring, you're getting a run at the title.
Getting a chef.
Yeah. And then being Rookie of the Year and the Intercontinental title with The Rock, being able to work an angle with him. And so I have been really, really blessed in the especially where the things I had to fight through to get there, to be able to have the opportunities, to be able to get opportunities to get those belts.
Right.
In those positions to get those belts. I've been truly blessed in that.
Right. What happened with the – where did the rift come between you and the UFC? What brought that on?
It's one of those things where Dana saw things one way, I saw things another. You know, I'm coming from it from a fighter standpoint. He's coming from a promoter standpoint. Prior to me having a discussion with him and talking with him, I had one thought, and he had one thought. I didn't know his thinking. I didn't understand where he was coming from. Now that after I've had the conversation with him, I kind of get what he was doing.
Right.
But at the same time, even with myself, now that I have an understanding of what he was coming from, okay, I get it, right? But I didn't have that understanding at first. I hope the same thing is with him. Now that he knows the direction of where I was coming from, that he would understand a little bit about why I was doing what I was doing. Because now that you have the whole picture of what each guy was doing and why they were doing it, then you should probably be able to have a true understanding about that. And if you still feel the same way, then, you know, obviously you can apply whatever it is you want to apply. But if there's a different thought process because you understand now what they were doing, then you can kind of change your strategy a little bit. And because I know where Dana's coming from and what he was doing, I'm not necessarily in complete agreement with all of it that he's saying or doing.
Right.
But I do have an understanding of why he was doing certain things, and now my strategy has to be different. I don't think I think I went at it wrong. I think I came at it from a bad spot. I came at it from being angry. Felt like he was taking advantage of me, and that he didn't care whether I lived or died. And I'm sure at one point in time he probably didn't.
Yeah.
But it was mostly on our doing that created that, not from any situation that we, one of us, each one of us did.
Well, what got you guys back on the same page together?
I think it's the we got to be able to speak to one another. And JT, one of my good friends, actually had a few people that he had talked to. But really the understanding was TMZ had been doing some stuff on this incident that happened with a bodyguard and a client and how they handled it, and it was public. And because I had been doing some work, it kind of took off in TMZ, and they were interested in, you know, fighter turned bodyguard. And for whatever reason, it, you know, it was like this superhero thing. I don't know. So they came to me and asked me what I thought about this guy's performance. And, you know, I said, well, I wasn't there. You know, and I don't know everything that happened before or after that. I don't know what transpired, but from what I see directly in front of me, you know, these are things that he could have done to prevent the situation from getting out of hand.
Right.
And I pointed those out. Well, and then TMZ goes over and they see Dana White walking down the street from a fight. TMZ runs over to Dana and they figure they'll get some dirt. And they ask Dana, they go, hey, Dana, what do you think about Ken Shamrock's comment on this bodyguard thing? You know, and Dana turns around and says, Shamrock's an idiot. He's an idiot. And they're like, what? He says, he's a complete idiot. Just talk to the guy for 5 minutes. You'll find out. And the guy, of course, TMZ goes, I'll throw some wood on this fire. Well, I've talked to him. He seems pretty intelligent. Dana just lights it up. Just all coming out. So TMZ goes, oh, we got something. So they run back, pick up the phone. Hey, Ken. Do you know what Dana said about you? And I didn't, you know.
Right.
And you know me, I'm always willing to, you know, fire a few things out.
Yeah.
So they go, well, Dana called you a complete idiot. He said you're stupid. Talked to you for 5 minutes. You can tell he's brainless and this and that. And my first instinct was to just, you know, do what I normally do. And I just had this thought, man, you know, that, you know, God was on me. And he, you know, going, it's not how we act. And just literally took over, and I said, you know, it's amazing that every time that my name is brought up or that his name is brought up, there's just nothing but negativity being said. I said, you know, I think we owe it to the fans. I think we owe it to ourselves, and I think we owe it to the organization itself that just put this thing behind us. I'm tired of it. I'm tired. I mean, I am. I'm done with it. And before it was over, I said, but I do want to say this. It says, I think it's because he's secretly in love with me. Thank goodness they didn't tell him that. So they went back to him and they said, hey, I heard Shamrock wanted to squash the beef. And Dana goes, really? Now, listen, this is Dana White, who doesn't, he's up there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's got a lot of money. He's powerful. He doesn't have to answer to anybody. And he says, really? Okay. All right. So he hangs up. TMZ calls up, says, hey, we told Dana White. And he says he wants to squash the beef. So, wow, that's pretty cool. I was shocked, but I didn't know what the deal was. Well, who's going to call who? So Dana picks up the phone and calls me. and says, "Hey, I want to squash the beef." And I was like, "Yeah, I just, you know, man, it's like, I don't even, where does this even start, man? You know, I mean, like, I know we have our issues and our problems with things, but it's ridiculous that we're firing off at each other for whatever reasons, bodyguard thing." And so he got heated, you know, there's no question, because we have a position that we've both had taken for so long about different things, you know, the fighter pay, fighter treatment. And so not really being able to talk to one another to really get an understanding, especially hearing media stuff and hearing other people, you know, we're getting everything third hand.
Right.
I didn't believe in everything that he had said, you know, on his position, you know, but it was his position. And at least I understood where he was coming from. And it wasn't just out of hatred and anger and dislike. It was out of a position that he had taken. Whether I agreed with it or not doesn't really matter. It just felt good that it wasn't just out of malice and out of anger. And so after we had discussed it for a little while, it was basically in a position where it was about time that we just stop. You know, no matter what one or the other thought, it's, this is stupid. And so I'm glad we're there now, because it really is. I mean, I have a history there. And, you know, it was a very big, very, very big part of my life. And it's a shame that I can't enjoy it without having some stigma to it.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Did you know that right now GEICO is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of the money GEICO could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your dog to make you breakfast in bed? With Belgian waffles and a fresh fruit compote? As nice as that sounds, that's probably never going to happen. But at least there's never been a better time to switch to GEICO. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit GEICO.com to learn more.
Do you still watch the fights? How often do you watch the pay-per-views or keeping tune with what's going on?
It's hard because I travel a lot.
Right.
I did get invited by Dana to the UFC Expo, and then I got to go watch the White Machida fight, which was a great fight, and also Ronda Rousey. And then I got to go watch BJ Penn. You know, wow. You know, just to be around that and have the experience with the fans live. And be a part of something that I just got to see grow from where it was when I started to where it's at now. It's unbelievable. The fighters there are just tremendous. The ability's tremendous.
What do you think about how the N-Octagon product has evolved into what it is today? I mean, because, you know, back when you were there, it was strikers, wrestlers. It wasn't the combination of striking, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, I mean, and everything that everybody's bringing to the table now. It was guys were kind of like, you know, you're a hellish striker, and you had your submissions, but it's changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, I was the first one to really actually go into the ring with both striking and ground technique.
Yeah.
You know, so, and back then, you know, you got to look at it, there was really nowhere to train for that stuff, so mine was pretty raw, although I still had it. It wasn't as developed as they are now. And it's like now there's, yeah, you come from a background, but it's not like you say this guy does karate and then you go in there and go, well, I could take him down, I could submit him. It ain't like that. They may have done karate, that may be their background, right, but they're an MMA fighter.
What did you think about the BJ Penn and Frankie Edgar? And then we'll get to Chris Weidman and Lyota. Which one you want to talk?
Yeah, I'm just going to try and do the comparison between BJ and
Gina. Go ahead.
See, the difference between those two in their careers.
Yeah.
Is that BJ knew it when he went into the fight,
right,
that he was done.
Right.
He should have never been in the ring, and he knew it going into that fight.
Right.
And you could tell the difference between his output of his fighting. He didn't go after the fight. He just tried to get through the fight, and
right,
he knew it. And the difference between Machida is that he found out during the fight. Even though he put on a heck of a fight, he knew his timing was off. And so that's why you've seen...
Did he say that post-fight?
No.
Okay.
So no, BJ Penn did.
Okay, BJ did, but...
But Machida didn't, but... But
you
I
think that's what
it.
He found out during the fight?
I think he found out during the fight that he isn't the same fighter he used to be. Even though he put on a tremendous fight against a tremendous fighter, but normally his instincts and his reflexes are better. In other words, he wouldn't get hit as much because he would have been able to see it coming before it came. I think he slowed down on that. And that's usually the first thing that goes is your reflex and your understanding when someone's going to hit you, being able to move prior to that. So you seen that on him actually diminish. And that's just it's going from being an elite fighter to right. a great fighter.
Yeah.
So he's still a great fighter, but he wasn't. Him and Silva both were at that elite level of a fighter, and they lost that little bit of a reflex action.
Right.
And now they're a great fighter. So, and you saw that happening. He saw it happen in the fight where he wasn't able to move in time, and he saw it happen during the fight.
Right.
BJ Penn already knew it.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Okay, so when did you know that you weren't an elite fighter anymore and decided it was time to retire from the MMA world and come into professional wrestling? Now, I'm going to come back, and we're going to talk about your days in the ring with WWF, going on about that. But talk about now just being retired in general. Has the I rode off into the sunset, man, 12, 13 years ago. I can't remember how long it was.
Yeah.
It was a very hard process for me to go through. Almost like a 3-year withdrawal period. And I did a lot of stupid stuff. I sat around and drank a lot of beer and hunted and did a lot of stupid stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, finally come to grips with it. And I'm sitting here talking to you in your crib. But how is it for you making the adjustment without the limelight, doing the work that you're doing? I know it's very satisfactory to you, but how did you cope when you first got out?
Yeah, well, for me, it was when I came back, I'd gotten out only because there was no money in MMA, and I had to support my family, so I had to find something else to do. And when I got into pro wrestling, it was awesome. I had a great time. I was very, very surprised and excited about the direction. And but at the end of that, when I went back and I fought over in Japan, I came out and I actually won my first fight, knocked the guy out. Then I came back and fought Don Fry, and I had some complications, but ended up going a tremendous battle with him, lost a split decision, and then I fought another
guy.
There's
no love lost on that deal. Did you and Fry more enemies?
We're good.
Are y'all good?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we put it aside. We knew that was a fight deal, and there's no reason to stay angry at each other, and we became friends. We're good friends today. And then I lost my second one. I knew at that point when I had come back that the sport had definitely gone by me, but my love for the sport was still there. I still wanted to compete. I know I wasn't the elite fighter I was. I probably wasn't even the great fighter at that time with the injuries and stuff that I had. I was probably a decent fighter then, but I still loved it, and I still wanted to do it. And so I just kept competing. I went in and got to go and fight Tito Ortiz. I was really going to retire after the Japan thing. I was going to get out.
Now, you and Tito kind of had a couple hyped up.
Oh yeah,
fused. I mean, no love lost there, or water under the bridge. You guys are both cool in the gang now.
Yeah, we're cool.
Was that a shoot back in? You guys not liking each other?
That was a shoot. Yeah.
Straight up.
Yeah, oh yeah, he hated me, and I didn't. I'm not. I hate's a hard word. I know he hated me, but I just didn't like how he treated people, even right. after a fight and stuff. But it was part of his gimmick. It was no big deal. You know, I did my thing. He did his. So, but we've gotten over that. You know, it was a hard one to get over because there was a lot of scars with the words that were thrown back and forth. So I know it was a hard deal for him. It was a hard deal for me, too. But we've gotten past it. You know, we're on good terms. So I'm glad for that because there is a history there. But I came from Japan. The UFC approached me. Dana White approached me because I didn't know if I was ever going to get in a ring again because of the Japan. You know, I struggled there. And they approached me about the Tito fight, and there was a lot of animosity there between me and Tito before we ever fought. So they gave me the opportunity to fight him. And I think I was 38 at the time. And so I took it. Because the warrior spirit, you know,
right.
Like, yeah, just let me hit him. I don't care if I just want to get mine.
Yeah.
And so we got in there and I trained for it, and I had a horrible training. Couldn't get where I needed to be, knee problems, and just struggled through training. And the fight comes around, and I'm never nervous to go into a fight, but this time I knew that I was going to have to get lucky. And that's exactly what I tried to do, is get lucky. And I caught him with a punch and almost dropped him. Split his chin open, but I couldn't follow it up because I would have to move forward and throw. My leg was right. Wobbly. So he took me down pretty easily because I couldn't block. And then we went three rounds and they ended up stopping the fight. I didn't quit. I wanted to keep going, but they stopped the fight, which is okay. I get it. So I'm frustrated. I want to fight him again. I know I could do better. I don't have a quit in me. And so they give me another fight. I win that fight. I knock out Chemo for the second time. I beat Chemo. So they give me a fight at Tito again. And the first fight I had with Tito, they were getting ready to shut the doors. UFC was. Right. They were going under.
Yeah. So times are pretty hard there.
Ooh, big time. I went back there when they told me about the issues and the stuff that they were trying to do. And the reason why they couldn't pay me the money that I wanted.
Right.
Because they were going to close the door. They were really struggling.
Because the second fight with Tito was 40, right?
No.
UFC 40?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, 40.
Because I believe it was this fight that Big John McCarthy was on record saying when he was in the octagon, that's when he felt that this thing was going to make it. Because all the years of struggling and, you know, going through the process that UFC was going through, this fight that was happening between you guys was when he thought that, hey, I think we're going to make the curve here and go for success.
Well, there was two structures, you know. It was when UFC first came out, it was me and Gracie that really well, opened the doors, right? And then the second time when the Fertittas bought it, when they brought me back to fight Tito, they were doing 37,000 buys. I mean, they were dying.
And y'all like tripled that or something.
No, we went from 37,000 buys to over 150,000 buys.
Right.
And then the second time around, we went to 900,000+.
Right.
And then we broke the TV ratings for the Major League Baseball playoffs for the Ultimate Fighter fight.
Yeah.
It was definitely a big thing for me, but I think it's important for fans and people to realize that, you know, I was 38 years old, 40 and 41 when I fought Tito. Tito was in his prime. He was an elite fighter, and I was definitely past my prime. I wasn't even a great fighter then. I was at an elite fighter. I dropped to a great fighter, and then I was down to a decent fighter.
Right.
I was a decent fighter fighting an elite fighter.
How does that work on your ego?
It hurts because you don't know how to lose. And right. So even when you do lose, you say you go back and you'll make it right. So you go back to try and train, go back, try and change things up. And it's just you've never, ever been able to fail. You've always found a way to fix it or win or come back and do better. It's never been a thing where you've never been able to do it. And so when you finally realize that, you know what, I'm just not going to be overcome this. It's age. It's getting old. And that nobody's able to overcome that.
Nobody.
And your mind is not ready for it. When you, even though you may think about it and understand it's coming, your mind's never really ready for you to stop, because your strength is that you never give up, that you always find a way to win. But your weakness is you think you can always find a way to win.
Right. So then what was the decision-making process when you said, hey, I walk now?
I never said that. That's how I dealt with it, was people said, have you retired? And I say, no, I'll never retire.
Yeah, but you went to WWF, so.
No,
you...
that was. I went to WWF after I went to Japan.
Right.
Yes, WWF after Japan. From there, I went into the UFC and fought Tito. Yeah.
Leaving MMA for the WWF 97 through 99.
That's right. Yeah.
Controversy at the Pride Grand Prix 2000. And then the return to MMA, the Pride Fighting Championship 2000-2002.
That's right.
Ultimate Fighting Championship, second spell, 2002-2006. And that kind of encompassed the Tito feud. Okay, here's the question. I was trying to get at retirement, but to hell with that. Which one's harder, being a mixed martial artist or a professional wrestler? You can answer this question better than anybody, because you grew up fighting and you wrestled and you fought for MMA. Which one's tougher?
Me personally, I don't know how it works for anybody else, but I think pro wrestling was a lot harder for me. And I think a lot had to do with just being on the road.
Right.
And every single night you had to go in there and just take these bumps and these kicks and these throws. And man, and when people say that it was fake, I look at them, I go, man, that's not fake. You know,
hey man, what kind of another ego check for you?
You come into WWF at the time, because you refereed my match.
Yeah,
you know, with Bret the Hitman Hart at Chicago, WrestleMania 13.
One that was a fight. Of my life.
Dude, that was badass. Was you was all jacked up, had your striped shirt on. So you come in, and but then you ultimately you get in the ring. Ultimately, no pun intended. But when you go from a shoot to a work, and all of a sudden, you know, you're not that guy anymore. You're special, and they built you,
right.
And we'll talk more about that later. But how much of a check was it for the ego when you got you go from you throttle people to hey, it's a work, and you're not winning every night here.
I didn't have a problem with it.
Because of your previous training?
No, I think it had to do with more of me understanding that, especially going in where I knew these guys. The effort that they put in the road they traveled to get there.
Right.
And I knew the thought process in their minds was this guy's coming from here and he doesn't, even though I did, doesn't have the credentials.
Right.
Or the experience that we have, and he's going right to the top and we put the time. So I knew all that. I knew all the thought process. And I knew that the only way that I was going to make it in this business was that I had the cooperation of the boys.
Right.
I couldn't do this myself. And I understood that going into
right.
it, so it was really important for me to make
were
sure.
Were you pretty well? I mean, you and me always got along. I can't remember the first day we met, but we were always cool.
Yeah.
But how was the rest of the locker room? Were they receptive to you?
You have to be careful too, because sometimes they're cool to your face, but
right.
then you got to worry about the backstabbing, because you know they're all fighting for a position. You know, there's
you
not too many there.
Yeah, everybody looking for a spot.
Yeah, so anything they could do to derail a situation where you know that's happening. So I knew that going in, but I really tried. I go up and shake people's hand when I walked into the locker room. I put myself in a position as a young wrestler, and that I'm young. I'm a young boy. And I'm here to learn, and that's where I really positioned myself. Even though I knew that, you know, I came from a place where I was on top. This is a different world, and I knew the only way right. I could make it was I needed their help. I knew it, and the only way I could do it was just be humble. You know, you're talking about these guys, they didn't have to do things.
Right.
You know, you know how it works. The guy go in there and mess up a couple spots, and the whole match is screwed up. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, Vince is not going to do anything, man. It's up to you to make things happen.
Yeah, Vince can strap a rocket on your ass, but if you can't fly it, it ain't going to go nowhere.
No, you're going to run into a mountain.
we're sitting here right now. I'm going to come back and talk to you about pro wrestling at another time. So now, Ken, I'm fixing to ride off into the sunset and go get into the gym so I can get in condition like you. But what's next for you in the near future? Where are you going to be?
Well, I'm going to be doing ministry work. I'll be traveling. And so really, that's kind of my main goal right now. Is to really get my ministry up and going. I do also do executive protection stuff. So I'm between myself and some organizations that I worked with before, I'm trying to do some executive protection stuff and maybe open an office up here in Reno to offer that EP work here. It's funny too, because it's almost like what we talked about retiring and trying to find your place in the world. You don't switch it off. It doesn't just go off. There's still that desire and that hunger to still be doing something. I can't just not do anything the rest of my life. I mean, yeah, I can't do that. I don't have that kind of money. I said, but I'm not broke.
Yeah.
But I do have to feel that openness and that thing that makes me happy, which is being a part of something.
It's a whole different ballgame, though, man. But I can relate to what you said about the replacing that with something else, because I remember, you know, back in the day, you know, guys didn't know what to do when their careers were over. And I remember talking to Paul Orndorff, and Paul Orndorff had to get out because he had that neck and that bad arm. And he told me, he looked at me dead in the eyes, and we were pretty good traveling partners and hunting buddies, and he said, Steve, he goes, there is life after wrestling. And I was still in, and I was already looking, you know, on the outside. I mean, is there really life after? What do you do? And I said, really? He goes, yes, brother, there is. You know, he's a spiritual guy, Paul is. But anyway, so I found out that there is life after wrestling. Yeah. And to me, man, I'm 49. But to me, I just believe in you got to work. You
yeah.
got to work. And you yes. never stop working, because you got to support yourself. And that's just what we're put here to do. And so you're doing the work that you're doing. I do the stuff that I'm doing, but at the end of the day, it's all about paying bills and being satisfied, and because I believe that when you put on earth, you're supposed to work until
that's
you
right.
can't work no more.
That's right. And when you stop doing that, that's when you see people get old and they die.
That's what my dad did. I mean, he wouldn't retire from insurance business. I mean, finally, and he was fighting cancer. I think he finally semi-retired when he was 72, and now he's 77. He's been cancer-free for 10 years. But, I mean, it took all the way. He worked his ass off till he was 72, and he had a hard time riding off into the sunset doing that. Yep. So I don't think I'm going to have that hard of a time walking away right. if I get that old.
Right.
But one of these days, I'm going to be kicking it on my rocking chair drinking a cold beer. I'm working on a beer right now. You've got an energy drink that's about to come out. Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, and we'll talk shortly on it because then you can just plug it too, like you do okay. the rest of the stuff. But it is. It's called Shamrock Slam, and right now we don't have it out in the public, but it is out there. You go to ShamrockSlam.com and you could check it out. If you wanted to get some, you can order it. But we don't have it in a major store yet because we're still finding that store that's going to fit.
Yep.
And one that will pick it up. Once we do that, then we'll get it out there. But, again, it's a really great energy drink, and it's also a drink that you can actually build muscle with on top of having energy.
So you've got branched chain aminos. It actually gives you energy. There's no sugar in it.
And electrolytes.
Close to zero. Yeah, it's got the electrolytes and almost no calories.
No, it's got 25 grams of calories. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
So 25 calories, and I got a box of it, so I'll file a report as well.
Yeah. So, well, yeah.
So, man, it's funny. I can't believe that you're a golfer. Yeah. I would have never in a million years figured you're a golfer,
Love
and you're
it.
Good at it.
Love it. Yes.
All right, I got to get my game up next time I come back.
Dude, I'm right here. I got a golf course right here.
I know you live on a golf course. Yeah. So if anybody thinks Ken's going broke, I'm in his house. He's doing great. He lives on a badass golf course. So anyway, I'm going to take my ass and go to the gym. With that being said, I want to say thank you to Ken Shamrock for letting me into his house and not put me in there. Hey, you've got to – what is the Achilles lock?
The ankle lock?
Yeah. Is it an ankle lock or the Achilles lock a variation?
I call it an Achilles lock.
Okay.
But some people call it ankle lock, but it is. That's what you're attacking is the Achilles.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but basically the one and the same.
Yes.
Okay. Before I came
in,
of course, I was reading all this stuff, and I was like, man, I got to get you to put me in a heel hook before I leave, and then I'll explain to it when I'm doing my clothes at the end of the show. All right. I'm sitting here talking with Ken Shamrock, and I'm hauling ass. Thank you, Ken, for letting me in the house.
God bless, man. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.